I do walk towards the fear. I don't say that it gets any easier. I just know that the reward is far greater.
Most of us have two lives. The life we live and the unlived life within us.
We all have our own road to walk.
Nothing's perfect and there's going to be a price for everything.
There are no rules.
Welcome to The Resistance. Featuring meaningful conversations.
I think I'm grieving the death of part of me.
It's not about being the star and being seen. It's about being.
That explore that very space between who we are and who we say we want to be. I'm your host, Matt Connor. Hello, and welcome to The Resistance. My name is Matt Connor, and I'm your host. I want to talk for just a quick second about lighthouses and just acknowledge that we all have them. I have a short list of names of artists who have really helped me overcome obstacles or provided words to my feelings and experiences when I couldn't come up with my own. Those people in those places often save us, and even in quite literally at times. And I have those experiences, and I'm pretty sure you do too. I bring this up because Mahogany Brown's work as a poet, as an author, as a curator, has been all those things for so many people, especially young Black women, to provide them spaces to belong in areas of the arts in which there often aren't those opportunities. Mahogany has worked so hard herself to claim those spaces, to earn those spaces with her wonderful talents. And now she's fighting for opportunities for so many the same, even as she's extending her own career. I love Mahogany's work myself and first came across it when I heard her slam poem Black Girl Magic in conjunction with NPR a few years ago. Since then, I've been following her and I'm looking forward to reading her newest work, Chlorine Sky, which is a brand new novel coming out in 2021. But listening to her, I realized just how important she is far beyond her own work to the opportunity she's providing for others. Today's conversation is all about what it means to face down your fears so that you become that kind of beacon that can call to others to do the same. It's really riveting. She's a wonderful person, and I'm just so glad for all of you to hear her story today. Here's our conversation on The Resistance with Mahogany Brown. I want to start where we begin each episode, and just to get your take on how you would respond to this quote. It comes from Stephen Pressfield's book, The War of Art. And Stephen writes this, that most of us have two lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us. And between the two stands the resistance. I guess at this point in your career or life, like what form does resistance take for you, maybe in the creative process or the person you want to be? Mm-hmm. And how are you battling that?
I love that quote because it is a constant, right? There's constant tension. We are in constant flux. We are not the same people we were a year ago. Honestly, we're not the same people we were 5 months ago. Look at this,
no doubt.
This pandemic. You come to terms with the person you are, right? You can't turn away from it. So the resistance that lives between those evolving selves, it depends on the day. It depends on the obstacle. Let me think. And of course, the craft. Yikes. So when I first started writing, between me and being published, the thing that was in the middle of that, in the way of that, was the ideas of who I was supposed to be. So say my family. Mm-hmm. And what a real job was, because nobody had ever heard writer or poet as an occupation. It was just like, no, you're going to work for the state of California, and you will be happy with that job, and you get to type on your day off. You know, like it was one of those things, like you could type on your downtime if you feel like typing. So that was the resistance. And then moving to New York as a journalist and finding that sexism ran rampant, that the patriarchy was very much alive, even though I didn't have the articulation for it, I recognized it. Mm-hmm. That was in the middle of me publishing the stories that really moved my blood. And then moving to poetry within that time at New York as a full-time occupation, specifically performance poetry, before I thought I was good enough for journals or thought my voice belonged in journals. The resistance then became reminding people that there is craft in so many different dialects, that there is necessary art in so many, from so many people from different walks of life. It couldn't just be the MFA program, and it couldn't just be from this specific region of the world. And it couldn't just come in a body that looks like, you know, mine or theirs or whatever. Like, the gatekeepers really had me fooled in believing that I had to subscribe to a certain kind of voice for my poetry to be valid. So I'm still there in that part of the resistance, because now I'm fighting from the inside out. I'm making sure that the people that are even like Poem A Day, I was able to curate Poem A Day for the Academy of American Poets for, you know, it's a small run. It was 2 weeks. And I went looking for folks that rarely are recognized in these learning spaces, these teaching spaces, as a part of the academic language. But they're the people that you ask to come and talk to your students. Do you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. you have that moment where you're like, oh, I'm good enough for you to, you like, put me on stage, but you don't see the value when it's on the page. And I decided that was my chance to fracture that idea and bring forth those voices, especially because I was told very, very early that my voice, my likeness, the things I was talking about was irrelevant. You know, it was just like, it's so, you know, I won't say, they didn't say passe, but they meant it. They meant fleeting. They meant it wasn't worthy. Honestly, that's what they meant. So from the inside out, now here I am after getting my MFA from Pratt Institute for the inaugural class of the writing and activism program. And I went in there and I just, you know, dug my heels in. I was like, I'm not going to write with, you know, whatever you decide I need to. No, I'm writing it this way. And I can articulate why I'm choosing to write this way, which was such a blessing. I went in as an adult. And so I was able to stand up and say, my voice is valid in whichever way, as long as I can make you understand why I chose these spaces and why I chose to not capitalize and why I break down the word Black in print. And it goes from B-L-A-C-K. And then after a moment of violence to this Black girl, it goes to B-L-C-K and then more violence. And then it's B-L-K and then more violence. And then the B is you remove the capitalization from the B. And I was seriously making sure I understood why those acts of violence could break down, you know, a young Black girl's identity to believe she was, you know, the lowest common denominator when it came to who's willing to fight for her, who's willing to protect her. And I was very lucky. My mentors and my writing director of the program, they were all about it. They were like, if you can explain it, let's go. But I understand, listening to other stories, that most people don't get that, you know, they get the, we don't get it, so you shouldn't publish. And then we're just taking away all guidance if you're not listening. And I didn't have that. But I think a large part of that had to do with me running towards the fear of not being understood and me using the resistance as a jump rope rather than, okay, this is blocking me off. Yeah, you know, so like the elasticity, like obviously jump rope makes it sound really fun and it's not, but I decided I wasn't going to let it rein me in and pull me away from my goals.
You said, I ran toward the fear. Mm-hmm. You know, which normally doesn't happen. Like, most people don't have that instinct. Is that pretty true for you? Even going back to childhood, is that a common posture for you toward fear?
I want to say yes, but that wouldn't be true. I learned that, especially after I think my 20s. I've always been kind of adversarial. Like, I've always been told, you know, I'm not enough, as a Black girl, you should be this skin tone and you should have straighter teeth. You should remove the gap. Like, the fact that I just had all of these ideas put on top of my head before I ever, you know, could realize that it was their ideas for me, not for myself. For a while, I listened and then I realized that it got me nowhere. Like, I was still scared and I was still sad and I still wasn't enough. Right. At the end of the day, I'm never going to be whoever, you know, whoever the world decides you should be. I'm not going to be that. I'm going to be me, because it's ever changing, right? The ideas of what is beautiful is very different. Who we decided was beautiful in this country has changed drastically over the last 20 years. It was just looking at it, that is different. So to understand that I would always be chasing someone else's idea of success and enough and worthiness, I just didn't want to do that anymore. High school, I think, was enough. High school was the key. And when I got to be, you know, early 20s and moved to New York, I saw, oh, this happened in high school. I was able to like really connect quickly with like certain behaviors. And I thought, that's when I started just being like, whatever, to the wind, let's go. My articulation came later when I read Audre Lorde and just her ability to wrap that fear up and use it as fuel. I really wanted to do that. That became the blueprint for how I walk in a room and how I show up on the page and how I ignite stages and curate spaces. It is Audre Lorde's like voice. It is June Jordan's voice. It is Nikki Giovanni and Sonia Sanchez and even Ida B. Wells, right? Like, so these people were like, the fear is it, like, what is fear? You know, that's a spice at this point. It's everywhere and you can't run from it. You just have to, you know, run towards it, because at the end of it, you realize the fear was really just you being in your own way more times than not. That's a healthy fear. But
sure.
The reality is, I mean, I don't even know if there's healthy fear for me, because I cliff dive when we were, I jump off cliffs at Jamaica and Hawaii, and I jumped off the bridge in New Zealand, and I just was like, I want to feel it. I want to feel that rush and be able to name it and taste it, because when I write, I want to be able to access it, you know, and it won't be this, this generated idea, you know, via Google. This will be something I lived. And every day, you know, there's a kind of fear that we have to access, especially now. Some folks who were like, oh my God, I didn't realize it was this bad. I received those text messages, and I'm like, yeah, welcome. Been here. You know what I mean? Take your shoes off at the door. We have work to do. So yeah, I do walk towards the fear. I don't say that it gets any easier. I just know that the reward is far greater.
Earlier, you were describing sort of the path toward the resistance of being validated and having all these things want to disqualify you, devalue you, or tell you you're not worth. How much of that, I mean, I just know in my own story, others that I talk to, that often serves as a continual fuel. Like in short, that there's really almost an inability to completely get over that for some people. And so they maintain that edge of proving those voices wrong, even as they're like very, very successful, that kind of never leaves them.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is present for you, and how much do you feel like you're over or have moved beyond sort of needing to prove those wrong in some way?
Oh, no, I think it never, unless you are able to write from a space of, no matter what I write, I'm going to be published, or no matter what I write, I don't care if I'm published, because I have a living, right? Sure. I'm making a living that does not depend on this being published, on my voice being listed, on being, you know, like the list of who you remember in 100 great books. Those things are like amazing for book sales, and it's amazing for the accolades and the nod and the recognition, but it's also painful. It's painful for people to realize, oh no, I'm not even like, even in this list of indie books, like I'm not even top 100. Like, what does that mean? Should I be creating art? And I'm glad that people challenge that idea. There can't be one list that decides for all of us. Make your own list. You know what I mean? There are so many lists that we are not heralding as the list to go to because of maybe the followership or the viewership. However, those are usually the best lists. Those are the most innovative. They're the most daring. You know what I mean? Like, you are giving us something that everyone hasn't just, you know, put their stamp on because this is the trend. You're doing some actual trench work, Like you're doing real work. You're like making us do work. And when you put together these anti-racist book club, which, okay, if you, I just feel like that list has existed all along, right? We just put a new title on top of it, but like you should already be reading that stuff. But I get it. Some people didn't know the language and here we are. But if you have the access, if you yourself are a reader, put that list together and share it. And I mean, once we start generating our own list, then we stop looking to others to validate us. I went on a tangent. I forgot the end of your question.
Well, I was just asking about how much you're still fueled by those voices.
Oh, yes. So I definitely am a child of adversarial. I love it. I play dominoes. I play spades. I used to play softball and basketball. So I realized a lot of that adversarial energy is that's the sweet spot for me. Mm-hmm. So when people were telling me, oh, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't sound like this. Really, I realized now that was probably aphrodisiac because I'm love it. I'm about to stay right here and make you mad every time you see me. That's not the best way to be. But yeah, I really just decided and not to say it doesn't hurt later, because of course, when you are off stage and when you are by yourself and you have to look yourself in the mirror, you start wondering if everything that everyone says about you is true. And then you have to come to terms with, well, do you love yourself, whether it's true or not? And if there's a thing that you can lead with from here on out, what would that be? And how do you do that? And it's time to do that, right? How do you sleep at night? That's really what it is for me now. It used to just be I want to be adversarial and I'm going to walk into it and I don't care. And then my feelings would be hurt. And then some lone little girl would send me an email after performing that same poem that was trashed, would send me an email saying, thank you. I never saw myself in poetry until you. Right. And then of course I say, well, these are the women that I see now. These are the people who brought me up. And I just introduced a new reader to the fold. And I had to be clear, I may not be everybody's poet, but I'm mine, right? I may not be everybody's writer, but I'm my own. And if I can just show, I guess I'd say my platform, I've been writing for Black girls all of my life. If I could just show Black girls that they are necessary in all shades, shapes, whatever walk of life, this is for you. You deserve to be here. If I could just do that, then I've done it right. Black Girl Magic poem that came out, I think it was 2015, maybe 16. And we did it for PBS and then it went viral. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a blow away. No one cares about Black girls. Really? You know what I mean? We'll put up Bring Back Our Girls, but who's really going to go fight for Black girls? And we have, all of these young girls who go missing here, and who really fights for them? So this is going to be a blip, I thought. And when it went viral, I said, oh, okay. All right. So we are here. You just have to, speak it at a different frequency, and you have to put yourself in a space where you are talking, regardless of who decides you deserve to speak about this thing. If you believe it, write it. And if you write it, share it. And, that poem moved in ways I never could imagine. And that helped me get my first illustrated book deal with the Macmillan, which led to a 5-book deal. And then, of course, my YA novel, which is coming out next year with another publisher. But all of that came from Black Girl Magic. You know what I mean? And I just never would have. I just never would have considered this was the poem. I just couldn't see it. I couldn't see it because for so long I had been told no one cares about Black girls but Black girls. And I just had to keep trying to take the hinges off the door. Mm. That's fine. I'm still going to talk to Black girls because we are worth it. And I know what it's like. I know what it's like to go through your life thinking you are not enough. And who cares if you are here? And we love your style, but we don't love you. And so my poems, they will remain to be a lighthouse in those troubled waters.
I love that description too, as a lighthouse. But if I asked for your most lighthouse moment for you, is there a moment you recall from youth or even adulthood that is that that captures that for you most?
There's two moments. One is when a little girl, maybe she was 6 or 7. She was in an oratory competition in Florida. She memorized Black Girl Magic. And a friend asked her if she could do the poem again so they could record it and send it to me. And when I tell you, that was it. That ended. I was like, oh, okay. It was just the most amazing thing I've ever seen, ever, ever, to date. And the second amazing lighthouse moment, like, it's still with that poem specifically. I was able to read that poem to open up for Sister Sonia Sanchez. And even the poem's layout, I shout out Sonia Sanchez because she was very big. She's very big on roll calls, right? And that the books, the flaps, are names of women, Black women, that bring me into spaces, both celebrity and familial. And of course, I cite her as the reason that I'm doing this roll call. And I was able to give her the book. And of course, we worked on like murals together. And so I was able to perform the poem for her. And she said, "That's my favorite poem, Mahogany. You're like, that's my favorite poem of yours." And that was it. I was like, I've made it. Everything else, shut it down. Close the shutters. Out for the season. If the season is a lifetime, I'm done. Hang it up. There's nothing else I need to do here. Nothing else I need to do here. Sister Sonia Sanchez knows my name. Nothing else I need to do here. She likes this poem. I'm done.
As you reflect back on your own experience, who was that lighthouse for you? You mentioned some names earlier, but was there one that sort of serves as the brightest?
I think like a pillar for me would definitely be Patricia Smith. She is also, to me, like when I found her work and I got to take a workshop with her, my Kavikanam regional workshop, she was the voice that I was always responding to when I wrote. She was the sun that I walked towards. Mm. And her writing, her being, that made me understand, like, there has to be space for you here. She is a Black girl through and through. She is a Black woman, but there is no shame when she's writing about love and sex and mass incarceration and family and murder and death. And then, of course, like, who else can personify the Hurricane Katrina? Nobody but her, right? So, like, just, I think she's definitely a pillar in my contemporary days. She was the first famous poet, I'd say, that I was able to write with and work with. And since then, like, she babysat my daughter when I had a show near Tarrytown, and she gave me a blurb for my first full-length collection. And she's the one that told me, "You need to apply to the Kavikanam retreat. Let's go. You should do it." And I thought, no, I don't have a degree. And I heard, and I don't think. And she said, no. Because I thought, if I hear you don't want me here, there's just going to be spaces that I'm not going to try and get to at some point. I just don't care. I'm going to make an adjacent space, you know? And she said, no. You belong everywhere. Come on. Do this application. Let me know when it's put in. And I was like, okay. That's it. She said, make it so. Of course, I applied and didn't get in. but it was a good start. It was a good start. Because when I told her, like, I didn't even talk about it. I just didn't get in. And I was like, I knew it. I knew I was going to get in because my voice, da-da-da-da. A year later, I decide. Oh, no. I wanted to go really bad as well because Lucille Clifton was the guest. So I didn't get in. The next year, Sister Lucille Clifton passed. And so then it was a year break. And I, at that point, Patricia was, you know, a part of my circle. So checking in was easy enough. And she said, "Did you apply?" And I said, "I'm not applying because they didn't let me in last time. So I'm not going back." And she said, "Mahogany, you have to. It's an application. Come on." And so I just said no. And I didn't worry about it. And then a year after that, she hits me again, same time, same rhyme. "Did you apply? Did you do it?" And I said, "No, I didn't do it. I'm not going to." And she said, "Mahogany, Ntozake Shange is going to be there." And I said, "Okay, I'm about to go apply." And that is the year I got in. That is the year I got in. But also, the world that opened up with me again, walk into the fear. What are they going to do? But most they'll do is say no. The most they'll do is say no.
Yeah.
What is the fear? The fear is of being told no, or the fear is having to like face the idea that you're not good enough. And that's a whole bunch of other work that has nothing to do with them. And so I had to just jump in and swim. And in that case, it worked that time. But it did change my life being a part of Kabe Kana, meeting Toy Derricotte in Tezaka Shange. I met her there first. Sapphire, the writer, I met her there. Amiri Barak, I met him there first, and then went on to like open up for him in this like weird space in Colorado at a college, maybe. Cornelius Eady and Terrence Hayes. And I mean, I was very lucky. I feel like anyone who's able to get into those spaces, it is not everything, but it is a beginning. You know what I mean? And it's just a beginning of you finding ways to talk about your poetry in spaces that constantly feel like it's judging you just for being. Like, I'm judged for being Black, and I'm judged for being woman, and I'm judged for speaking a certain way and speaking a certain tone and not being feminine enough and being too, like all these parameters for like what is enough. I think it's a constant for everyone. And in that particular space, I finally got to, I didn't have to talk about the majority of the things that drove me, like, why do you care about what color my hair is today? Or it's not your business. No, you can't touch my hair. You know what I mean? Like, you have those things that are like those, what they say, microaggressions. And then someone said, no, they're not micro, but you're constantly fighting off the cultural, not differences, but like ignorance. Like, sure. I am not your Google. I'm not your Google. You can go look it up. You can read the books. Uh-huh. And even before Google, there were books, there was magazines. You can involve yourself in learning about other people than what we've been conditioned to consider as normal, as average. So I didn't have to think about that there. So like, there's a certain piece of armor that I put down. And the writing became more vulnerable because I'm not holding up all of this armor to assure that, you know, you don't talk about your maid to me, which definitely happened in a writing workshop.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's just like you think you're going in for an art and craft space and you realize you're there to help someone get through their racism.
Oh man.
Right. And that's shit. That sucks. Yeah. That does not feel good. And honestly, most of us aren't even prepared for that kind of legwork. All right. That emotional labor, you're not paying for. You're paying for a writing workshop. And I'm not even the facilitator. That's fun. I'm a peer. I paid to be here, too. And here I am facilitating. What?
Yeah.
No, man. I just want to write. You know, I just want to write. And now I have to write about your ass. Because you got all up in my way, and here it is, racism again. Really, I feel like racism is a large part of the resistance work, because a lot of us are trying to heal from the abuse that we've received as normal behavior in everyday interactions. And then the gaslighting that exists, which is to say, like, no, I didn't mean it like that, or they're a good person, or they're not racist because they date someone who's of a different ethnicity. Right. Yeah. Got it. And I have to write about your ass too. Like, I have to just get it off of me so that I can get to the actual story. I want to write about, you know, missing my father who's been incarcerated for the majority of my life. I want to write about my mother who has survived addiction. I want to write about my daughter and the fear I have and, you know, being a single mother for so long. And then of course, the pitfalls that I don't want her to subscribe to. And then I want to write about love. I want to write about geese. I want to write about manatees. I would love to just look at nature and let that metaphor swallow me up. And then me come out reborn. I would love that. But guess what I got to do to even get to that nature? I got to stomp through the shit that you have laid as a country, as easy as it is to just, you think it's a throwaway, but that has so much like slavery and racism and sexism and the patriarchy and the white supremacist machine has so much, it's so much embedded in our everydayness. Our DNA is messed up. And so the things that we do are actually dysfunctional. We do it as a throwaway, a fleeting thing. I didn't mean it like that. It was a joke. That's dysfunction. That's dysfunction. Because if someone looked at this from a screen on a TV, you know what I mean? Like, it would be like, you would see the POV. The POV would change. And you would see like, oh, what happens to them is they go home. And when they go home, this is who doesn't get to eat because now they're depressed. Or this is who's hurt. Or this is who doesn't have a home. And now they never, like, all these things are connected. And we have to look at our hand in it and be accountable. We have to be accountable. We have to do better. And it can't be a, I'm human, because we're all human. If you are human and you make mistakes, and you know that you have to learn something, and if you have to learn something, do not do it off the backs of other people. Put your skin in the game. Be uncomfortable. You be uncomfortable holding that mess. Don't put it on someone else and have them suss through what you're trying to say and then give it back to you all shiny and gleaming. You take care of it. You do that work.
It just sounds exhausting.
It is.
It sounds exhausting to be tasked with, like you're describing, like you got to do the work before you can do the work.
Yep.
Which is just such a, you said it's its own resistance in itself, but yeah, that's really just profound and eye-opening in many ways. Mahogany, I'd love to give you a chance to tell us, you mentioned some things in the future. I'd love to hear about them. If you'd want to tell us what's coming up for you creatively, the plates you're spinning and what you're excited about.
Mm-hmm. So my first YA novel in verse is coming out January 12th with Crown, Penguin Random. And I'm so excited because it originally was a poem. And that poem was about my 14-year-old self looking back or looking from above at a swimming pool incident where it basically, you know, it is the Lego model of the entire world. So it's this 14-year-old brown-skinned black girl in a pool with other kids. Her best friend is a light-skinned black girl, and her realizing how different they're treated, her realizing how expendable she is for a joke when it comes to her friend, someone she would protect with her body, her life. And then when she's the butt of the joke, the friend just laughs it off. And so then you start looking at that moment where someone realizes even those who love me will hurt me. Even those who look like me will hurt me. Even those who look like me will say the things that I've already said about myself. Like, I've already been mean to myself before I even walked out the door. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's in the voice of this 14-year-old. So it started off as a poem. I love the poem. People really, you know, they vibrate with the poem. And then I made it into a full length 192-page novel in verse. And it was scary because I had to come to terms with like the realness of it, right? Like a lot of that stuff I still hold, you realize, newsflash, we're all writing out of our childhood traumas. But now the book also not only talks about colorism, but also talks about gender norms and gender rules and sports and mass incarceration and socioeconomic like division, like who, you know, who are you proud of when you get to go home? And this, of course, it's changed drastically. It used to be my 14-year-old story, and now it is a 14-year-old story because I brought in so many different other examples. And also the person that I wrote about originally, I just believed that she, you know, obviously it's like the epitome of beauty as a 14-year-old. Like, that is who I decided. If I want to walk in a room, I want people to see me like her. And then I wrote this thing, which ends up feeling a bit scathing, of course, perspective, because, you know, she was my best friend and she let people laugh at me. So I decided she didn't love me. And in turn, when I went to like finish the novel, I went looking for her and she just had a bad life. Right. And so then I had to come back to the page and be really honest about what I was trying to say, because now I'm an adult and there's a different responsibility. Right. We're talking about these aggressions that we place on other people. Here I am. My 14-year-old self experienced this, but my 40-year-old self can do something different. Mm-hmm. I can humanize the character in a way that I couldn't see clearly as a 14-year-old. I just know you hurt my feelings. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you so much. I don't want to be your friend. Like, that's all I knew. And then now I had to give the character some space. I had to give her, you know, some dimensions. And I rewrote it for 2 years before turning it in. And now I absolutely love it. And it's scary because I had to relive it and I had to come to terms with it. And what we know about writing poems, sometimes that poem takes a long time to get off of you. And I feel like this novel in verse is very much that. It took a long time for it to get off of me. And I'm just happy it's coming into the world. So that's January 12th. I also have a book form poem. And that's out with Haymarket in spring. And it is called I Remember Death by Its Proximity to What I Love the Most. And it is part one of a part two series. The second part is a book of essays, What Metal Makes of Us. And both of them are talking about mass incarceration and the impact on women and children. So those are the three things coming up.
You've been listening to The Resistance. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate us on iTunes and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And for more information and further episodes, you can find us at listentotheresistance.com. Engineering, production, and additional music by Jake Kirkpatrick. My name is Matt Connor, and I'm your host. Thanks for listening.